Hi, friends. Maggie Creech here, host of Revolution Revisited. If you've been tuning in, you know we're diving deep into the people and stories that made the American Revolution what it really was. Messy, bold, and full of rebellion right here in Virginia. And if you've learned something new or found yourself saying, wait, I never knew that, I'd love your help spreading the word. Wherever you listen, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, leave us a rating or a quick review. It only takes a few seconds, but it helps more listeners discover Revolution Revisited and supports the work of the Virginia Museum of History and Culture, the team behind this show. Every review keeps history alive and keeps Virginia's stories in the spotlight as we commemorate America's 250th anniversary. So go ahead, hit those stars, drop a line, and keep spreading the word. Thanks for listening and for making history with us.
Welcome to Revolution Revisited, your crash course in the American Revolution. As the 250th anniversary of America's independence approaches, dive into the stories of Virginia's rebels, rule breakers, and rabble rousers who shaped a nation. This podcast is brought to you by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture and made possible by William and Karen Fralin.
Welcome back to Revolution Revisited, your crash course in the American Revolution. I'm your host, Maggie Creech. By now, the battle lines are drawn. The Continental Army has formed. Dunmore's proclamation hangs over the colonies, and ordinary people are facing a choice they've never confronted before. Who will they stand with? But here's the thing. The way we learn about the American Revolution in school makes it look simple. Patriots on one side, loyalists on the other, neat and tidy. Clear heroes, clear villains. Reality? Far messier. Loyalties were fluid. People switched sides. Families were divided. Communities fractured. Over the next two episodes, we'll dig into the tangled web of decisions, pressures, and circumstances that shaped these choices. And joining us for episodes 4 and 5 to help untangle that web is...
My name is Andy Talkov, and I am the Senior Director of Curatorial Affairs at the Virginia Museum of History and Culture.
I'm Christina Vita. I am the Elise H. Wright Curator of General Collections at the Valentine Museum in Richmond, Virginia.
My name is Ashley Spivey. I am a member of the Pamunkey Indian Tribe. My day job is I am the Executive Director of Kena Consulting, which is a locally based anthropological consulting firm that works predominantly with Indigenous communities. A lot of the work that I do is around tribal history, tribal historic preservation, and some of the work I've been doing with several partners across the state is talking about Indigenous representation in the Revolutionary War.
Today's episode might sound a little different. We're not doing a deep dive into a single battle or tracing the arc of a few months. Instead, we're jumping around, exploring the choices everyday people made during the American Revolution. We've already heard from the politicians and the planters in the House of Burgesses. But what about everyone else? How did location shape their lives? A Virginian in the backcountry faced a very different reality than someone living in Norfolk. How did race shape the call for freedom, ringing one way for the enslaved while another for white individuals? Socioeconomics also played a role. Merchants might weigh a boycott differently than planters, and community mattered. Who did your neighbors support? And circumstance, above all, often tipped the scales. Today, we'll focus on patriot perspectives, and in episode 5, we'll shift our lens towards some loyalist leanings.
It's probably a relatively new phenomena that people are actually thinking about patriots and loyalists, because for a long time, it was usually patriots and redcoats, right? So you were either a soldier that fought in the British Army, or you were a patriot. And a huge portion of the population got ignored for a long time because they didn't really fit the patriotic narrative that had tried to be established of the revolution for so long.
In a world without social media, how did Virginia even track who supported the patriot cause? We're not talking about the famous names, the speeches, the public resolves. We're talking about everyday people. Ordinary Virginians, people whose loyalties were hidden in plain sight. How could authorities identify them? How could communities tell friend from foe?
So in 1776, the Virginia Convention actually requires that men 16 years old or older need to take a loyalty oath. This is hugely controversial, particularly in the backcountry, where their sort of rampant sense of independence prevents people from wanting to take loyalty oaths of any kind.
Even in southwestern Virginia, a region famous for patriot leaders, support was complicated. Daniel Morgan, a frontiersman and military tactician, rose to prominence for his role in key battles of the Revolution, including Cowpens. The Overmountain Men, a militia drawn from the Appalachian frontier, became legendary for crossing the mountains to fight at King's Mountain, a decisive patriot victory in 1780. Yet, even in areas where patriot sentiment was strong, ordinary Virginians had to navigate local feuds, neighborly disputes, and the logistical demands of swearing loyalty oaths. What might seem to some like a clear moral choice was often entangled with personal survival and local rivalries.
So, you know, if you're not showing enough support of the patriot cause, someone could brand you a loyalist, and you get hauled in front of a court, essentially, and need to prove your patriotism or take the loyalty oath.
The patriots themselves did not hesitate to enforce loyalty. Legal measures targeted confirmed or suspected loyalists, and sometimes even avowed neutrals, like the Quakers. Confiscation acts allowed the seizure of property. Public humiliation, isolation, and occasional violence reinforced these divisions. And it wasn't always a binary choice. People's loyalties were fluid. Take the events at Chiswell's Lead Mines in 1780. These mines, located in southwestern Virginia, were critical for producing ammunition for the war effort. Control of the mines was strategically important, and disputes over labor and loyalty among the miners reveals just how complicated allegiance could be in wartime. Workers shifted their support depending on who controlled access, who paid them, and who could keep them safe. People changed their minds. People seized opportunity. People fought to survive. Some, who would later appear as soldiers in the Continental Army, had fought against that very same army just a year before. History, as always, is never tidy.
So that's the great point of consternation among the patriots, is defending the lead mines. And so in 1780, the loyalist threat seems to come to its peak. The loyalists are encouraged in southwest Virginia to make an attempt at the lead mines because the British move their military campaigns primarily to the south. So the idea is that they could destroy the lead mines, unite with indigenous people, fight their way to the British army, and then help subdue the South. In June 1780, about 200 loyalists gather not far from the lead mines. But what oftentimes happens with these loyalist plots is that they're undone by people that are in their own ranks. And so the plot is given up to the patriots. A lot of patriot militia in the area gathers around the lead mines, and the loyalists sort of disperse. And then they start rounding up people. So more than 70 people are rounded up, put on trial. And remarkably, one of the ways that these were adjudicated is that if you had been convicted of a more minor offense, you could join the Continental Army. They're converting loyalists, or people that they suspect of loyalists, into Continental soldiers by making that the way that they can essentially get out of trouble.
As we can see, patriots did not always join the cause for the reasons that we think. For some, it was less about ideological lines in the sand and more about practical decisions. The ability to put food on the table for their families, or the desire to survive when presented with the option to switch sides. History is in the context. And for some people, the siren calls of life and liberty had a different meaning. As we dove into last episode, in 1775, Dunmore's proclamation offered freedom to any enslaved person who fled their patriot enslavers to fight for the British. And many seized that chance. Others, however, found their path with the Continental Army, despite the risks and uncertainties.
The Black community was hearing the ideological messages that were coming out of people like Patrick Henry and Thomas Jefferson. And I suppose in some communities, there could be a sense that those people were going to act in the way that they said they were going to act, that they did believe that they could somehow mentally transfer these ideas of breaking the chains of slavery with the mother country to actually breaking chains of slavery for the people that they enslaved.
One extraordinary example is a man often known as James Lafayette or James Armistead Lafayette, an enslaved man from New Kent County. Recent scholarship, which we will discuss in a moment, has clarified details of his life, leading us to refer to him as James Fayette. His story illuminates the complex and often contradictory choices enslaved Virginians faced during the Revolution.
James had been enslaved by William Armistead in New Kent County. William Armistead is a Patriot supporter. He is also a commissary for Virginia, which means you're gathering supplies. You're trying to get food for the army. And I do believe at this point that he is offering up James's services as someone who is gathering things together and offering up services, makes that connection to the Marquis de Lafayette. James then serves the Marquis de Lafayette as a spy in the camp of Lord Cornwallis.
A caveat here. When we talk about James Fayette's service, it's important to remember he was an enslaved man. His participation in the war was not entirely a choice of his own making. He was, in many ways, voluntold through the circumstances of enslavement. Enslavers sometimes sent their workers to fight in their stead, and the line between willing service and coerced labor was often blurred. James's story, remarkable as it is, must be understood within that context.
And apparently he does really well. He is able to provide enough critical information back to the Marquis de Lafayette that Lafayette writes to George Washington about this man that he has on the inside. And so these are contemporary letters during the war. So we know that Lafayette has this trusted man who is in Lord Cornwallis's camp. Obviously, Yorktown does not go well for the British. They lose, the Americans win. And then there's this delightful story that has no basis in a primary source that I am yet aware of, in which apparently Cornwallis comes to pay his respects to Lafayette a few days after the peace has been agreed to. And he sees James and he says, "Ah, you rogue." Now, I've really dug around for this letter. I don't think that this actually happened. I fully believe that this story gets created in the 1820s when James has sort of another rise to fame, which we can talk about. But he does, I think he has this moment. So James, who later becomes known as James Fayette, he has this opportunity. He doesn't necessarily have to do what the Marquis de Lafayette is asking him to do, right? Like, he is given this position to have some freedom, and yet he chooses to give good intelligence back to the Marquis de Lafayette, which in many ways sort of helps the Americans win at Yorktown. And I appreciate, just from a zoom out perspective, you have this Black man who is enslaved. He has no promise of freedom. He doesn't know what's going to happen at the end of the war. He is probably very well aware that many Black Virginians have self-emancipated to Lord Cornwallis's army, and that many, even earlier, used Lord Dunmore's proclamation to escape behind British lines. So he's aware that freedom has been attained from many of, particularly, Tidewater residents, Tidewater enslaved Virginians. And yet he continues to play both sides with this lack of understanding of what could happen in the future. So to me, in my opinion, I do believe that James had to have in some way like supported the Patriot cause, right? Because why else would you throw away a chance at your personal freedom if you didn't also believe in what not only your owner, but also folks like the Marquis de Lafayette?
The people we encounter shape the choices we make, and James Fayette's story illustrates that perfectly. As an enslaved man, his circumstances constrained him, yet his proximity to the Marquis de Lafayette, a committed abolitionist who debated the hypocrisies of slavery with Thomas Jefferson, had a profound influence on him. Perhaps being so close to a man who genuinely believed in the ideals of liberty allowed James to believe in them too. Lafayette ultimately played a decisive role in securing James's freedom. In 1784, he petitioned on James's behalf, writing that James has done essential services to me and perfectly acquitted himself with some important commissions, closing that James appears to me entitled to every reward his situation can admit of. 2 years later, James submitted his own petition, invoking his honest desire to serve this country and the just right which all mankind has to freedom. The petition succeeded, and in gratitude, he took his new last name, a testament of thanks to the man who helped him claim his liberty.
While James Fayette has his freedom, it does mean that for him to help his family members become free, he can acquire them, purchase them, count them as his enslaved, while also giving them that sense of freedom within the personal confines. He comes to Richmond twice a year to receive his pension payments from James Heath, who was the auditor of public accounts. The Library of Virginia has all of those records. And if you look on the outside, they're all labeled James Lafayette. But if you look at the actual signatures that James is signing, he is signing James Fayette. So in the paperwork organizing later, some great librarian labeled everything James Lafayette, because Fayette and Lafayette are very similar. But I do think it's pretty cool that he's even tweaking that own name. Like, he's not calling himself James Lafayette. He is calling himself James Fayette, coming in twice a year, signing that pension paperwork.
Even freedom didn't produce a uniform experience. Free Black men navigated the revolution differently, facing challenges and contradictions that enslaved people did not. Take William Billy Flora of Virginia. Flora, a free Black man, enlisted in the Continental Army and served in campaigns across Virginia and beyond. He earned recognition for his service, but his experience also highlights the limits imposed by systemic racism. Loyalty and bravery did not automatically translate into equality or social standing. His story reminds us that the revolution's promises were unevenly distributed, even amongst those who fought for them. Speaking of uneven distribution, understanding Indigenous perspectives from Virginia's revolutionary history is challenging, as the scholarship in this area remains largely underexplored, with much work still to be done.
I will say where we are is kind of ground zero, where, to be frank, Indigenous people writ large in our history and historical experience writ large really only very recently have been a part of the narrative. And again, that's been predominantly focused on the early colonial period, right? We're kind of bookmarked around 1607 to 1677, even though we have thousands of years of occupation of this land prior to 1607. And we have been here living our lives and surviving for the past 400 years beyond 1677. Of course, our people have experienced the tides and movements and events of Virginia history, just like every other community. And that includes the revolution. But unfortunately, there is very little, quite frankly, if any, public history approach to understanding the Virginia Indian engagement in the Revolutionary War. The Brafferton is key, I think, was one of the key contexts, because a lot of the students that attend the Brafferton, not just from Virginia, right, but English colonies, and these, again, these are Indigenous boys that are attending the Brafferton, are being exposed to, in the colonial capital, right, of Williamsburg, to very much patriotic ideals, and are seeing firsthand how the colonial government is kind of reacting to what they are perceiving as British oppression. So that is a key context, 100%, and definitely plays into the narrative, and it can't not be a part of the narrative because it's so key. One of the other places that we could start are within the Indigenous communities themselves, too. I'm from Pamunkey. I obviously know Pamunkey the best. And there's not a lot regarding historic documentation around Indigenous engagement in the war. It's out there. But what we do know is heavily based off of one veteran in particular. His name is Robert Mush, who was a Pamunkey Indian. He was born on the reservation around 1758.
Despite the omnipresence of Indigenous communities in Virginia's history, the Mid-Atlantic has far less research on colonial and early American policies and Indigenous diplomacy in the 18th century than New England does. Yet, these communities were deeply intertwined with the political and military currents of the time. Throughout the 1600s, the Virginia government negotiated a series of treaties with local tribes, shaping relationships, trade, and obligations that would carry into the Revolutionary era. When the Revolution arrived, these agreements complicated loyalty. Tribes faced difficult choices: align with the British Crown, honoring long-standing agreements, or side with the emerging patriot leadership, including the Virginia politicians they knew personally, now leaders of rebellion. These decisions were never purely ideological. They were shaped by centuries of diplomacy, local relationships, and survival, highlighting just how layered the question of allegiance could be. For instance, during Lord Dunmore's War in 1774, the British Crown sought to assert control over the Ohio River Valley, leading to conflicts with indigenous nations like the Shawnee and the Mingo. The subsequent Treaty of Camp Charlotte aimed to establish boundaries and peace, but it sowed seeds of division amongst indigenous groups. Some viewed the treaty as a betrayal, while others saw it as a necessary compromise to avoid further conflict with encroaching settlers. In contrast, the Cherokee Nation experienced internal strife during the Revolution. A faction led by Dragging Canoe, known as the Chickamauga, allied with the British, launching attacks against American settlements in the South. This division within the Cherokee Nation exemplifies the complex and often painful decisions indigenous communities faced during the Revolutionary War. These examples underscore that indigenous allegiances were not monolithic, but were instead shaped by a confluence of historical treaties, personal relationships, and the harsh realities of survival in a rapidly changing world.
Where are these indigenous communities kind of siding, and why are they siding the way that they are? So the overwhelming majority of tribes, again, in the British colonies, are actually siding with the British. And a big part of that is because they believe that if they uphold their relationship, especially through those treaty negotiations that have been developed over, again, well over a century at this point, that they will be able to work with this known, what is that saying, the devil you know, keep your enemy closer or whatever kind of thing. Okay, we know what we're working with here, right? It's not great, it's not perfect, but we know who we're working with. And we believe that we can continue this relationship to ensure that continued westward expansion, which a lot of colonists that end up being patriots are pushing for. It's the folks who become patriots who are really pushing for more westward expansion. And so a lot of tribes, especially in the North, see that continuing alliance with Britain will stamp out this call and this push for more westward expansion, which what does that mean? It means more taking of Indian land, right? So they want to stop that, or at least they want to slow that down. So that's one of the core decisions around why a lot of tribes are continuing alliance with Britain. Then you have tribes who decide to remain neutral. And there's a lot of various reasons for why tribes just decide not to pick one or the other. They're like, we're going to pick ourselves. We don't trust either one of you. We're going to hold our sovereignty and see where the coins lie, so to speak, with this aftermath, right? We're not going to make decisions right now. And so they choose themselves and they pick neutrality. And I want to also emphasize that neutrality is not, I've seen it in a lot of cases represented as passive. It is not passive in any way, shape, or form. Neutrality is a very tenuous political decision in that climate and context, and it should be viewed as such. And then you have Virginia, the indigenous communities in Virginia kind of breaking the mold a little bit in terms of what is typically being seen across the landscape. They are siding with the patriots. And I think there's a lot of reasons for why that is happening. And quite frankly, too, more research needs to be done in the context of Virginia and the Mid-Atlantic region. I feel like the work I've been doing is just scratching the surface.
Working theories suggest that the environment of the Brafferton School played a complicated role in shaping early patriotic ideals in colonial Williamsburg. Established in 1723 at the College of William and Mary, the school was designed to anglicize Native American boys, teaching them English, Anglican religion, and European customs under the guise of education. Students from tribes like the Pamunkey, Chickahominy, and Nottoway were often removed from their families and immersed in an environment that sought to erase their cultural identities. While housed and educated alongside instructors in Williamsburg, they were also exposed to the city's political and intellectual currents. Even as the curriculum was intended to instill loyalty to the crown, the very proximity to revolutionary ideas may have inadvertently exposed these students to concepts of liberty and resistance. In this sense, the Brafferton was not a neutral school. It was a site of cultural coercion, but one that paradoxically may have helped to sow the seeds of patriot sentiment in the colonial capital, while also empowering indigenous individuals with the skills needed for them to negotiate on behalf of their communities in dealings with Europeans.
For example, Robert Mersch, who I mentioned, the Pamunkey individual, witnessed the Stamp Act protests in Williamsburg, for example. They're around this fervor. They're around and witnessing what is happening on the ground. And I think that in many ways, it influences decisions around why they choose to participate on the Patriot side. Alongside Robert, who, like I said, attended the Brafferton. So these are fellow students who attended the Brafferton with him and also joined, again, Virginia-based regiments supporting Patriots, includes George Sampson and Gideon Langston. Both were veterans in the Revolutionary War. Unfortunately, we do believe George Sampson, I'm fairly certain, did die due to illness during the war. So he did not survive the war. Those are two additional names. We also have a really interesting reference here from a man named Stephen Freeman, who we believe was Nottoway. He is in his pension application. That's where we get a lot of our information from, is the pension applications, which are like a treasure trove of what folks were experiencing during the war. But he made a really interesting statement where he is talking about that there were many Indians. I'm going to quote him now, okay? Many Indians, free Negroes, and descendants of Indians in the Army of the Revolution who not only served faithfully, but who have received land bounty of the latter description, are the persons of now asking relief. I'm speculating here, to be fully honest, for my next part, where we didn't have a good relationship with the colony. I feel like time and time again, we were witnessing just the complete ignorance of our treaty with Britain over a century by the time that the revolution rolls around. You've only got, I think, by the 1770s, there's only 4 reservations that haven't been terminated or allotted or forced removal from at that time. So that's Pamunkey, Nottoway, Mattapani, and Gingaskin or Gingaskin, which is in the Eastern Shore. And then by the early 19th century, Nottoway and Gingaskin aren't even on the maps anymore regarding official colonially recognized reservations. So I think too, I'm speculating, but I think there's probably perceptions around why are we going to continue to work with this colonial power that really hasn't been in any way, shape, or form benefiting us. So maybe doing the opposite, which is going against treaty, by the way. I think it's one of the few instances where tribes are breaking treaty stipulations, because part of our stipulations is that we would come to the aid of the British in violent conflicts, and we chose not to do that. Several of the communities in Virginia chose to do the opposite and join the ranks of the Patriots against the English colony. Up north was this continued westward expansion. And again, with us here, and when I say us, not just Pamunkey, but the tribes in the Tidewater region of Virginia, at least, yeah, our land was already decimated. We weren't fighting off troves of westward frontiersmen or whatever, trying to look for land. That had already happened to us. And so I think at that point, like I said, we saw the colony as the aggressor because of that versus the Patriots as the aggressor, when I think it was the opposite, right? Because of different contexts and different relationships.
Jane Collins, a Pamunkey woman, offers a glimpse into these tangled histories. She traveled with her husband, John Collins, likely supporting his regiment through cooking, cleaning, and taking care of soldiers. But tracing her story isn't simple. Jane Collins is a name that could belong to a white woman, a Black woman, or an Indigenous woman. It's a reminder of the challenges historians face in piecing together lives that were often overlooked. As Ashley Spivey emphasizes, uncovering these stories requires working closely with tribes who still carry these histories through their own records and oral traditions.
That is honestly one of, I think, the biggest challenges for non-Indigenous researchers, especially for folks who are not from this region. Because I am from the Virginia Indian community, I know the names that have existed within our communities for hundreds of years, since the colonial period. So when I see that name, and they're coming from King William, or King and Queen, or Caroline, or Amherst County, like, I know we're talking about an Indigenous person, especially when you get into the way that Virginia was trying to legally classify people in terms of perceived, again, race. It typically extended towards a bilateral approach. So you're colored or you're white. And yes, there was early colonial documentation throughout the 17th and 18th century that do talk about Indians, especially the Black Codes of Virginia. Indians are included in that. But when it comes to, again, that general classification, racial classification of Indigenous people, especially those who are not living within their reservation communities, if you don't know this history, if you don't know these families, you're going to look right over them. And so I think that's why myself and my team, who has worked extensively in Virginia Indian history, we know what we're looking for. And so that's why we've been able to pull, because I guarantee you, if Joe Schmo historian, no offense to any other historians out there, you know, comes in and they see Jane Collins, as you said, or a John Collins, they're not going to think twice, but I'm going to think twice. And I think that's also what I'm getting also at the importance of Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous perspectives, how they need to be included in all aspects of history, because for how long, I feel like, has this portion or part of our history been left in the dark? It's because nobody's been talking to the Indians. And I just so happen to have pursued a degree in anthropology, historical anthropology, right? So I get to have somewhat of a voice out there that I still don't think anybody listens to, but I'm trying my best.
The story of Jane Collins raises an important question. What about the women of the revolutionary period? We've spoken in past episodes about figures like Christiana Campbell and Clementina Rind, and there are countless other women who contributed throughout and after the revolution, often in ways that history has overlooked. In the Continental Army, women frequently served as camp followers, a term that belies the critical roles they played. They mended clothing, cooked meals, and cared for the wounded, tasks essential to keeping the army functioning. Many received pay or military rations for their efforts, a practice that could spark controversy given the scarcity of wartime resources. These contributions can often be glimpsed in pension records, where widows recounted not only their husband's service, but also their own. Through this documentation, historians have uncovered the names and stories of women like Sarah Osborne, Nanny Major, Sarah Major, Nancy Cook, and Jenny Langston. Ashley Spivey and her collaborators have worked extensively with these records, illuminating the lives of women whose labor, courage, and persistence were indispensable to the Patriot cause. Their experiences remind us that the revolution was not fought solely on the battlefield, but also in kitchens, tents, and homes, where women sustained the war effort day after day. Choices in the revolution were rarely simple, and understanding them requires looking at more than just politics or geography. Location, community, family ties, socioeconomic status, race, and circumstance all played a role. But even those factors don't tell the whole story. Sometimes people make decisions they make because of something intrinsic to them, something that defies easy explanation. Take Peyton Randolph and John Randolph. Both were born in Williamsburg, Virginia. Both attended William and Mary. Both became lawyers and politicians. And yet, when the revolution came, these brothers stood on opposite sides. Peyton Randolph emerged as a leading patriot, serving as the president of the first two Virginia conventions, the First Continental Congress, and briefly the Second Continental Congress, before his death in October 1775. John Randolph, in contrast, boycotted the Virginia Convention, fled to Scotland with Lord Dunmore, and continued to advocate for reconciliation with the crown. Their stories remind us that allegiance was not predetermined, and that even shared upbringing and education could yield radically different choices. There was no single path to loyalty or rebellion. Each decision was shaped by a web of influences, and sometimes by qualities we can't fully trace or define. Next week, we'll explore another side of this story, the Virginians who chose to support the British war effort and the complex motivations that led them there. Thanks to our guests, Andy Talkov, Christina Vita, and Dr. Ashley Spivey for sharing their insights. For those interested in learning more, visit the Valentine Museum's upcoming exhibition, Descent, opening in February 2026, that will explore how Richmonders navigated freedom and loyalty during the Revolutionary era. Special thanks to Virginia Humanities for supporting Dr. Spivey's research and to Encyclopedia Virginia, which will soon publish an article on Robert Mersch. For more episodes and resources, including primary sources referenced in today's episode, visit virginiahistory.org/podcast.
Thanks for listening to Revolution Revisited. The American Revolution was not an ending, but a beginning. The stories continue to unfold. Subscribe now and catch the next episode for another journey through history. This podcast is made possible by William and Karen Fralin and presented by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture.
Revolution Revisited is a production of the Virginia Museum of History and Culture. Our production staff includes Haley Finner, Maggie Creech, Riley Reynolds, Nicole Martirana, and Tracy Schneider. Be sure to subscribe to get notified about upcoming episodes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Explore 16,000 years of Virginia history. The Virginia Museum of History and Culture offers a variety of exhibitions, public programs, and special events for the whole family. Learn more and plan your visit at virginiahistory.org.